Board of Advisory. Mr. Sankler received his bachelor's degree in mathematics and statistics from the University of Minnesota Duluth, and in 2003 was inducted into the UMD Academy of Science and Engineering. So without further ado, Peter, thank you for joining us here in Minnesota today, and thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. All right.
I have a problem, which is that my voice is really in bad shape. This has never happened to me before, but I'm going to have to speak in a very conversational tone and hope that I can get through this. So whoever is running the mic, make sure that it's loud enough. I am not an economist. I'm not a social scientist. What you're going to hear is the musings of a journalist who has watched government for 35 years at all levels. And I need to take full advantage of my journalistic license to be very broad and superficial. The current word that sticks in my mind as best describing trends we're seeing in the world now is unsustainable. It is used repeatedly by economists in their analysis of what they see as significant imbalances in the world economy. What's going now, they are all saying, cannot continue. It is used repeatedly by people I know in government, like Mike Leavitt, the former Utah governor and now HHS secretary, who I think is one of the more thoughtful politicians I've ever met. And he uses it to describe the federal government and the states, what they face in paying the expanding bills for Medicare, Medicaid, and so on, as well as Social Security. It is used repeatedly by planners and environmentalists in describing how we are expanding and developing our land and our natural resources. And it's used repeatedly by those who study trends in our energy production and consumption. What am I talking about? Take economic imbalances like our federal trade deficit. We're gorging on imports while other countries like China and Japan and Germany are too dependent on exports. And racking up record surpluses. Our current accounts deficit this past year was almost $900 billion. We need to export more, and they need to consume more. China, in particular, has been investing most of its trillion-dollar surplus in dollar-denominated U.S. stocks and government and corporate bonds. So far, it has worked, but the dollar now is falling, and if and when there is a weakening in the markets, it is likely to fall further, testing the patience of those holding these U.S. investments. Take income, and there's good news there. Our exports are beginning to go up a little bit, and Asian consumption is beginning to go up a little bit. Take income inequality, which is a growing trend both here in this country and in the world at large. As in income inequality has reached near record levels in many countries, the distribution of the world's wealth has become more concentrated. By 2000, which is the last year for which they have world numbers, the top 1% of the world's population, that's some 37 million people, with a net worth of a little over $500,000, accounted for about 40% of the world's total net worth. That's the top 1%, 37 million people in a world with, 6 billion people, accounting for 40% of total net worth. The bottom half of the world's population owned only 1% of total assets. Developing countries are not developing fast enough, while rich countries, particularly the U.S., have seen faster growth and a spectacular buildup of assets, with the notable exceptions of China and India. The third world is drifting behind. Remember, that data is 6 years old, and some of the greatest growth in China and India have occurred since then. Americans have amassed much of the world's treasure. In 2000, the U.S. accounted for 4.7% of the world's population, but almost one-third of all net worth. Nearly 40% of those people in the 37 million, the wealthiest 1%, are Americans. Take population growth. Knowledgeable people will argue about how many people is enough in this country. We just passed the 300 million milestone. only 4 decades after hitting 200 million, and almost a century after hitting 100 million. The census projects that by 2050, we'll be at 420 million people, or an increase of 40%. The United States now is virtually the only advanced country in the world significantly increasing its population. The two main reasons, of course, are aging and immigration. Immigration being figured, and I think rather conservatively, at about 1 million people a year. There are obvious benefits. A highly diverse country probably is better prepared to compete in the globalized economy than one where everyone is pretty much the same. But most observers would agree that our immigration policy has been careless and haphazard, not guided by any particular strategy other than turning our heads the other way when we are seeking low-wage, low-skill workers. And that's pretty much what we are getting at the moment. The hope, of course, is that these new immigrants will give the economy vitality just at the time we need heavy public revenues to cover soaring Social Security, pension, and health care costs. We sure have a stake in making sure these immigrants are able to pick up the tab and are willing to pay it. Aside from the immigration question, there are concerns about what another 100 million people or so will mean in terms of quality of life, density, and air and water pollution, preservation of farmland and open space. We're already experiencing significant problems with water and the fast-growing Southwest and other places. We're increasingly aware that we have to both develop more energy and conserve it. But when population increases at a rate that it is now, it means that there are more homes to heat and cool, more cars on the road, and so on. So even if we're very successful in finding alternative sources, in conserving and producing energy, we may still find ourselves in an unsustainable situation. Unless we show some foresight about these larger economic and demographic issues, it's going to be harder to remain competitive in the world economy while maintaining our historic standard of living. True, these are not, by and large, issues over which states exert much control, but they do form the backdrop, the context, in which states are going to have to operate in coming years. So what are the areas where states can take control, where governors, state legislatures, and managers, along with their colleagues at the local level, and I would underline that, can move the trend lines from unsustainability to what is clearly a more competitive position? I think there are 6 or 7 that seem to predominate, many of them very much interrelated. The first one is really repeat it again and again, is education, physical infrastructure, healthcare, tax systems, public management, and then what I call quality of life, environment, arts and amenities, and finally I throw one in called the state of our culture. Education, obviously, number one, and I think high quality preschool education is the one that is the area where most people and states are extremely interested now because of the data showing that if you do it well, you eliminate lots of problems down the road. But then there's K through 12, higher education through graduate programs, and I think it's an area we've been ignoring at our own peril in the last decade, adult education and retraining, remedial programs for those left behind, everything that contributes to the betterment of our workforce. The emphasis in each state might be different depending on the economy of that state. We have to make sure we're funding every level adequately, but also that we're getting a sufficient return. We have to ask ourselves why we're paying as much or more to educate our population than most advanced countries, yet achieving poorer results than many. We have to ask why kids seem to be worse off in writing, in math, and in science. Yet clearly, and we're accentuating those now, but clearly we're ignoring history, geography, civics, particularly civics. And then there's no time for PE or for the arts and music. We have to ask why business is having to do so much remedial training of employees just to bring them up to standard, that they expected public education would provide. My wife and I were driving along the other day and listened to National Public Radio to a story out of a Baltimore high school that was chilling. And it was about a principal who was handing out awards to faculty of this high school in inner city Baltimore. What for? For showing up for work. The truancy rate among faculty had been so high that they were now offering awards to people for attending school. And it obviously, the problem got deeper. This faculty was deeply demoralized because of the pupils they were having to handle and what was being asked of them, and what they were doing was just having a lot of sick out days. It was a very upsetting story in some ways, and yet you could tell in the interviews with this teacher, you really felt for her because the problems were so dismal in this school, because this faculty was so downtrodden, and she had been able to achieve enormous results by this little program trying to raise their morale and so on. Boy, you know, when that's what's going on in our inner city schools, we've got a real problem. Infrastructure. It's getting a lot harder to move around. We're wasting much more time in traffic, use of mass transit, and walking are falling as a percentage of commuting. Larger percentages of people are driving alone to work than just 25 years ago. And we're now wasting 2 billion gallons of gas in traffic jams a year, a number that keeps on growing. It's harder to meet the needs of everyday commerce. This clearly is unsustainable and unproductive. The estimates in some states of the cost to simply catch up with the required maintenance of what we already have in states like Pennsylvania and Colorado, Massachusetts, California, Indiana, are prodigious. Along with the drop in funding of its state university system, poor road maintenance had a lot to do with the vote in Colorado, led by the conservative governor who had passed it, of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. It has to do with why Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, and Richie Daley in Chicago are essentially selling off infrastructure to private companies to operate and maintain them, providing those jurisdictions with much-needed cash to meet other maintenance needs. It's why Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania is asking the financial community to come up with some buyers for the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And John Corzine, past head of Goldman Sachs, is doing an inventory of all the infrastructure in New Jersey to decide what can be long-term leased to other companies to provide the state with the money it needs to handle its own infrastructure. It's why Arnold Schwarzenegger successfully got the voters to agree to borrow $37 billion to meet the needs of his state's infrastructure. Healthcare. Almost no one is happy about how our healthcare system is working now. In a nutshell, just like in education, we're spending more than anyone else except maybe Switzerland and are way down in the list of outcomes. So it's another bang for the buck dilemma that we got to solve. It clearly is not sustainable the way it's going now. It is inefficient and it is a serious drag on our company. And if you don't believe that, ask the CEOs in our auto industry or anyone else who is trying to compete on a worldwide basis. The number of uninsured is rising again, and the states will likely to continue to peck away at the problem in the wake of the passage of the compulsory plan in Massachusetts. But there's a lot more at stake here. States will have to continue making progress in reducing Medicaid costs, and at what price to Medicaid recipients, I can't tell you. But if they're going to have to do that, if they're going to remain fiscally healthy, because the growth in that program is now crowding out education and infrastructure, which are the key components of a competitiveness strategy. This state and California and Maryland, New York, Missouri, and a number of other states are candidates to take action this year. On our website this morning, I saw a story that Arnold Schwarzenegger, speaking from a bed because he can't walk because of his ski accident, is proposing the most ambitious healthcare, state healthcare program in the country, $12 billion initially, in a plan that sounds like it's based off of the Massachusetts plan. Critics are already saying he's underfunding it. But Arnold is not a guy who seems to think in small ideas. My guess is that we will continue inching ever closer to some form of universal health care using very different models in different states. Tax systems. Many of our state tax systems are imbalanced and, to say the least, very dated. There finally may be change coming, but I'll believe it when I see the legislation pass. The immediate catalyst is sticker shock from property tax bills because of soaring assessments. But many economists and good government types sense an opportunity here to accomplish what they have been advocating for years, aligning tax codes more closely with how and where the economy has been growing, to the professions, to the services, to the knowledge economy, the information economy, and away from the taxation of the manufacturer of goods and the ownership of property. The best example here is Boeing and Microsoft, next-door neighbors. Boeing, a much smaller company in market cap, paying a much larger share of its income to King County and Washington State than Microsoft because of the way we tax. If we don't start rewriting tax codes, modernizing them, then I think the pressure will continually be there to just keep raising taxes on the same people we're already taxing. Public management. I do believe that government sets the bar too low and that we are too protective of the status quo. I do not believe that government should be managed like a business, as so many people say. Governments are not expected to make a profit. They are expected to deliver all kinds of services to a wide range of constituents, and the most needy are the least able to pay. This is not a great business model. They are expected to operate in the open. They are expected to share all trade secrets. They have far less leeway with their employees. But that is not to say that they cannot operate in a more business-like manner. I believe we have been far too accepting of the culture of fragmentation in our entire governmental structure, of old bureaucratic models that are designed for governments and not for citizens. Legislatures should pay more attention to public management because, after all, public money makes up about a third of our entire economy. I don't believe so much in fraud and abuse as serious problems. I do believe in waste, in the sense that public dollars can be stretched further. The buzzword now in public management is transformation, and it's not a bad word. We need to transform how we're doing things. Ambitious management overhauls, like the California Performance Review, have been very good at identifying waste and duplication, but then too often they have died of their own weight when presented to legislatures. Performance measurement is slowly catching on as new technologies are capable of allowing us to capture data in real time, and some governments, particularly in cities like Baltimore and New York City and Chicago, are doing some amazing things. We have a story on that in this issue, by the way, on how performance measurement is catching on, which I really recommend to you. And I noticed on our website this morning, we have a little section of the website called Ideas Center, and there is an item about Virginia state government that has just put up a website called Virginia Performs. And what it really means is that any citizen in the state of Virginia can see how the government in Virginia is, how public service is performing in all regions of the state, region against region, and then Virginia, how it's performing against all other states. It's a brilliant idea. It's divided up into about seven different areas. It's something that you ought to take a look at. And then finally, hold on a second. Need some juice here. Finally, quality of life, amenities, environment, and the state of our culture. This is a very amorphous subject. I really had to question whether I ought to include it, but I think I should. It is not easy to define a return on investment here, but arts and amenities, green space, quality design of public structures, good planning for land use and development on a regional basis really matter, probably much more than we realize. Again, I think cities are leading the way. Chicago stands out probably as the foremost example. Denver, Seattle, Portland in both Oregon and Maine, Charleston. Build museums and libraries, and they will come. Install bike paths, and commuting will skyrocket. They're doing that in Chicago in a massive way now. Preserve quality old architecture, and you can revitalize downtown neighborhoods. I've seen it in cities all over the country. Finally, this question of values. I think that in the red and blue back and forth dialogue about values, the so-called social issues, the wedge issues, we're missing a whole lot of common ground that liberal Democrats and Christian conservatives actually share, and we should be accentuating that. There was an article, just let me point out one last anecdote, from another high school, or this is a middle school in a suburban Long Island neighborhood. There was this article that appeared in the New York Times called Middle School Girls Gone Wild. And it is the most emailed article that's been in the New York Times in a long, long time. You know how they list who's emailing most, what is being emailed most. This was the most emailed article for weeks. Very short, written by a guy who had, took his 10-year-old daughter to their first student talent show at this Long Island middle school. And what he saw there in this talent show absolutely amazed him. It was young girls, these are 12, 13-year-old girls, doing a choreographed dance. And it was close to lewd. And I've seen this sort of thing before. I really wouldn't believe this. But I won't describe it all, but it was extremely sexual, very erotic, and so on. And these girls, in a way, had no idea what they were doing. And when this thing was over, the parents and everybody else were cheering. He adds in this article, "It is news to no one, and not even me, that eroticism in popular culture is a 24-hour all-you-can-eat buffet, and that many children in their early teens are filling up. The latest debate centers on whether simulated intercourse is an appropriate dance style for the high school gym. What surprised me, though, was how completely parents of even younger girls seem to have gotten in step with society's march toward eroticized adolescence, either willingly or through abject surrender. And if parents give up, what can a school do? A teacher at the middle school later told me that she had stopped chaperoning dances because she was put off by the boy-girl pelvic thrusting and had no way to stop it. The children wouldn't listen to her, and she had no authority to send anyone home. She guessed that if the school had tried to ban the sexy talent show routines, parents would have been the first to complain, having shelled out for the costumes and private dance lessons for their little Miss Sunshines. Now, that's a problem. And I think we all have to acknowledge it, and it will have a lot to do with, I believe, how we fare in the next 20, 30 years, how our children and their children fare. And so I decided that I would include the question of values in our culture as a competitiveness issue. Thank you.